Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether the benefits of the Affordable Care Act will emerge in time to overcome the growing concerns about the healthcare.gov website that is feeding into the perception shaped by decades of conservative propaganda that the government is the problem and private enterprise is the solution. Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, joins us to discuss the birth pangs of Obamacare. Then we'll examine the role of private contractors in the train wreck of website woes that are stymieing the launch of the new healthcare insurance exchanges. Scott Amey, the general counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, who investigates federal spending on goods and services, joins us to look into the contractors responsible, Serco, Equifax, and CGI, who have already spent over three times the amount of their original bid, and whether the tech surge Obama has promised will overcome the already negative perceptions of healthcare reform. Then finally, we will look into the Benghazi hoax, the title of a new book by Ari Rabinhaft, the Vice President of Research and Communications at Media Matters for America, who has meticulously chronicled the right-wing lies behind the politicization of an American tragedy on September the 11th, 2012, in Benghazi, Libya. We will discuss the wholesale manufacturing of a phony political scandal by a failing Republican candidate for president, an unscrupulous congressman who is a serial grandstander, and Fox News. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he is also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thanks for having me.
And I should think in the last few days, you're getting a lot of grist for the mill in terms of your new book. And the politics of healthcare and health reform have been so tortured with the government being shut down in an attempt to kill Obamacare and even threatening to tank the economy. And just as we recover from that gun to the head, now the website that's launching the Affordable Care Act is having its problems. So what's your sense of this continuing political agony? Is it all going to end up okay?
I don't think we know where it's going to end up. Health reform is never short of drama, that's for certain, and there's plenty of drama to go around. I think the fight over the debt ceiling and the government shutdown and the efforts by Senator Cruz and others to defund Obamacare underscores the extent to which the healthcare fight is not over. You would have thought it would be over by now, but it's not, far from it, and is still very much an issue that is the source of great partisan division. The situation with the website is not good. The rollout for the health insurance exchanges, especially the federal exchange, has not been what the administration wanted. It's a great disappointment, and it's a real problem. If they can get a hold of it sometime soon, that won't matter very much. But if this persists, it really is going to be an issue going into the next year.
So is there any evidence at this point, Jonathan Oberlander, of the extent to which these problems with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act via healthcare.gov, which is obviously problematic, is there any evidence of how much it's affecting the enrollment in these new exchanges, which is really key to the whole effort?
So we don't know, and that's a problem. The enrollment data that we're getting is sporadic, and we do have some data from states, and there are some states where this is rolling out in a more successful way, including places like Kentucky and Washington State. But in terms of the federal government, which is operating the exchange in about three dozen states, they have not released official data. They've told us how many people have started applications, but that's different than actually enrolling in a program. We have anecdotal evidence from insurance companies and other sources saying that the enrollment numbers so far are quite modest and in some cases very, very low indeed, but we really don't have a hard and fast number yet.
And do you think that any heads are going to roll? Is there, I imagine there are calls, of course, for Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, to be fired from Republicans. Obviously, that's somewhat predictable, but I take it that if the president were to do something like that, he'd be acknowledging that there's a problem here and that needs to be, you know, addressed by somebody being sacrificed. So what's your political read on the recriminations?
I don't know how many heads are going to roll at the end of this, but there is no question that somebody needs to be held accountable. This should not have happened. There is no excuse. Yes, they're operating in an environment where there's great political division over the Affordable Care Act, where it's difficult to get support administratively, where they ended up running exchanges in many more states than they thought they would, where they can't get the kind of funding they would like to have and the administrative resources they would like to have. And this is a complex task. All of that is true. At the same time, there is no excuse to roll this out in the condition that it was rolled out in. And if I contrast this with Medicare's rollout back in 1966, where it was, yes, a much more accommodating political environment, but on the other hand, they were very worried about demonstrating that the government could run a health insurance program given American ambivalence about the government's role in medical care. And they did everything in their power to make sure that Medicare had a smooth takeoff. And this has been anything but smooth. They still have time to recover, but it really is a situation that should not have happened. And I do think somebody should be held accountable.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he is the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. So is there, though, any chance that this whole effort of healthcare reform is going to get our hands around the big problem, which is the out-of-control medical costs in this country, which are taking up to as high as 18% of GDP compared to, say, 7 or 8% that other advanced democracies spend on healthcare. That was always, in many ways, the rationale for why we needed to have reform in the first place, was because it was such a budget buster. Is there any evidence that these spiraling costs will start to come down?
The United States has many problems in healthcare policy and many big problems. And I think the central rationale for the Affordable Care Act was expanding health insurance coverage. That really was the core rationale behind the law. On the other hand, it's certainly the case that the United States has the most expensive system in the world, and another rationale for the law was to try and do something about healthcare spending. The irony is the rate of growth in healthcare spending in the United States has actually slowed down the last few years, and that is something that I think has not gotten a lot of public notice, but it has slowed down, and significantly so. We don't really know fully why that is. A lot of it, maybe most of it, has to do with the economy, but not all of it. And it's not clear how much of it has anything to do with the Affordable Care Act. This trend, this slowdown, started before the Affordable Care Act was enacted. So I suppose if you believe in time travel, the Affordable Care Act would have been enacted in 2010 and gone back in time to slow down healthcare spending. But short of that, it's hard to make sense of it, and it may be that some of the things that the law is doing are having an effect. Certainly, the law is going to slow down the rate of growth in the Medicare program. I don't think there's any question about that, and it's already starting to do that. The bigger question is what it will do outside of Medicare, and I don't think we know the answer to that.
So, in general, I spoke with a physician yesterday, and he made the point that the focus should be on having choice for providers as opposed to choice for insurers. Is that just inherently the way this Affordable Care Act has gone? In other words, it's really an insurance-based program as opposed to a, you know, certainly not a single payer. So is that a valid criticism?
Well, I think in the United States, we often assume in health policy that the choice that people care about and only about is choice of insurance plan. And in fact, I think a great number of people care much more about their choice of doctor. They want to see the doctor they want to, and they may not even be sure what kind of insurance plan they're in. And so we do tend to prioritize choice of insurer over choice of physician, and it doesn't have to be that way. But certainly the Affordable Care Act's approach is to think about choice of insurance plan for those who are on the exchanges. Most of us, of course, are not going to be affected by the exchanges one way or another. And some of those exchange plans are going to have very restrictive provider networks, particularly the very low-cost plans. And the higher-cost plans will have broader networks where people can choose providers. So I do think it's a debate worth having and a discussion that we need to talk about. What matters to people and what should matter, choice of insurer or choice of physician?
But it seems that in the political domain, in terms of the way this argument is shaping up and the way that the Republicans are getting traction on it, because I think there are a lot of people that believe that in effect what Obama's doing is putting a bunch of freeloaders on their dime. In other words, the people who oppose it are people who think that it's going to cost them, their insurance is going to go up in order for a bunch of people that they consider unworthy to be insured. And do you think that that is, you know, being effectively challenged, that idea that Obamacare is a free lunch for freeloaders at the expense of hardworking, red-blooded Americans?
Well, I think the answer to that is, first of all, most of the uninsured are working Americans. Most of the vast majority of them are in families where they're working. It's simply that they're working for a business that's very small and can't afford to provide coverage, or they're working in an occupation that has a very high uninsured rate, for example, construction, where the risks are great. So most of the uninsured are not freeloaders. They're working Americans who don't have access to affordable coverage. And I think we have not done a good enough job of explaining to Americans who the uninsured are. So that's the first point. The second point, which I think is really important to say, is that in most cases, this is not going to be a free lunch. Yes, people are going to be subsidized who are very, very low income, but all of us who get employer-sponsored insurance are subsidized as well at a very great expense through the tax system. Many of the folks who are buying coverage through the exchanges are going to have to pay a significant amount out of pocket, particularly for deductibles that are much, much higher than most insured Americans have. So in most cases, this is not going to be a free lunch, and in many cases, it's going to be a significant financial strain for many Americans to afford that coverage, even with the law. The third thing that I think is really important, and I do think the administration has not been able to effectively make this case, is the Affordable Care Act is not just about the uninsured. It is about the insured as well. It's about making coverage more affordable and more accessible for those who don't have it and more secure for those who do. And so if you have coverage right now, in many cases, you're going to get a lot of new protections where they're not going to be able to take your insurance away because you have a pre-existing condition, not going to be able to turn you away from individual insurance if you were to lose your job and had to go that route. You're going to get new benefits if you're on Medicare, new preventive benefits, new prescription drug benefits. If you're in the private market, again, you're going to get new preventive benefits. There's going to be a cap on how much you can spend in a year and in a lifetime to make sure we protect people from medical bankruptcy. So there are a lot of benefits in this law for people who already have insurance. And the reality is, and in most cases, according to the Congressional Budget Office, insurance premiums are not going to go up very much at all for most Americans who have health insurance coverage. And in many cases, those premiums may come down a bit. So I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And one of the great failures of the health reform campaign in 2009 and 2010 was to explain the benefits of health care reform to the insured.
But isn't the whole idea to bring the cost down? I mean, isn't that how it's going to be judged? That, and obviously in this political year coming up in 2014, I'm sure it will be an issue. Obviously, if the Republicans hadn't behaved in such an insane and suicidal way recently, they would have had a stronger case against so-called Obamacare. And now they've handed the Democrats an election issue, which is how can you vote for these irresponsible people who shut down the government and threatened to tank the economy? But that aside, do you think that there is some traction here in basically, if it doesn't cost you less and the results aren't evident, won't this basically take the wind out of this thing?
Well, I think that's part of it, but that's not all of it, because remember, there are about 3 million Americans under the age of 26 who have gained coverage because of the Affordable Care Act provision that families could put them on their coverage. So it's not just about what happens to premiums. It is, in a sense, always difficult to measure premiums, because if the Affordable Care Act keeps premiums from going up as much, that is harder for people to sort of get a hold of than if the premium directly goes down. And again, in the short term, the impact on premiums is going to be fairly modest one way or another. So I think the case the administration has to make is, yes, on cost grounds, and there are also many Americans who have already gotten rebates from their insurance companies because of the provisions in the law, but they also have to make the case that this makes insurance coverage more secure.
So do you think that Koch brothers are going to have any traction then with their campaign through this front group called Generation Opportunity, where they're actually encouraging young, healthy people not to sign up in these health exchanges? And obviously the president recently made a joke about it by suggesting that if you get sick, don't turn to the Koch brothers. He never named them specifically, but I mean, it's a bit hard to swallow that these zillionaires are out there telling people they shouldn't get health care. But
it's a dangerous message, because on the one hand, it seems rational, but the point of insurance is uncertainty. It's to protect us against that unpredictable risk. And you can be as the healthiest 25-year-old in the world, but you just don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And at a actually quite reasonable cost in the exchanges, because they have special policies for younger Americans, you can get that protection. You can get that security. I don't know how much impact that campaign is going to have. I think actually the ineffectiveness of the website is a much greater threat to that cohort if they don't get it up and running better soon.
So at the end of the day, then, what you're telling us is there are an awful lot of, you've talked about aspects of the Affordable Care Act that simply I don't know about, and I'm, you know, trying to be relatively informed here. It sounds like there's an awful lot of good stuff that we don't know about, and whose fault is that?
Part of it has to do with the complexity of the law. This is not a program like Medicare. It's not a program. It's a series of policies and regulations and subsidies and rules that treat different groups of Americans in different ways at different times. And it is difficult, very difficult, to develop a coherent narrative and explanation of the law out of that. The Affordable Care Act is an effort to patch the holes in the American patchwork system. So part of it has to do with the complexity of the law. Part of it has to do with some of the struggles the administration has had in explaining the law, again, particularly the benefits to insured Americans. And part of it has to do with misinformation and propaganda. One way of understanding the law's troubles is that many Americans don't understand that there are provisions in the law that are actually quite popular and they like a law, and they don't understand they're in the law. And they believe there are things in the law, such as death panels, that are mythical. That's not a good combination politically.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, Second Edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the role of private contractors in the train wreck of the website healthcare.gov.
Tell everybody, wake
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Amey, who is the General Counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, where he directs contract oversight investigations and testifies before Congress and federal agency panels on issues of federal spending on goods and services, the responsibility of top federal contractors, and conflicts of interest and ethics concerns that have led to questionable contract awards. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Amey.
Well, thank you.
And the president has promised to do a tech surge to overcome the problems with the launching of the Affordable Care Act via the website healthcare.gov that has obviously had problems. My understanding is that many of these problems basically can be identified in the fact that the whole system has been put together by a bunch of contractors developing different aspects of the system, and perhaps there's been some lack of compatibility between the various components in this team of contractors. So is this again a situation where we're looking at private contractors and outsourced government services?
Well, I think so. I mean, through the years, we have seen a lot of outsourcing. Specifically, we've seen service contracts now outnumber the amount that we spend actually on goods in the federal government. We're spending close to 60% of our dollars on labor hours and bringing in management services, IT services, into the federal government. So it is something. I mean, IT isn't going away in the near future, and so the federal government has to decide whether it just wants to rely on the contractors for these types of services, or if it can bring in an in-house capability that can do this itself. But one of the things that we have to ask is, why do we do so much outsourcing? I mean, it's been kind of sold as an agenda item of cutting large government and the size of the federal government. But all we've really done is supplement a workforce that used to be public servants with contractors. And that's where, you know, we spend over $500 billion a year on goods and services, and over $300 billion of that is on services. So all we've really done is shift one workforce from one category to the other with a lot less accountability.
Well, apparently the government is becoming more and more dependent upon these contractors, and they're relying on a shrinking list of these preferred contractors, particularly in the IT world. So is that a part of the problem with healthcare.gov?
Well, there are many problems with healthcare.gov. I mean, you know, and unfortunately, there's not a lot of answers. I mean, there was a very quick turnaround time to get this website up and running, and it, obviously the scope of work is very expansive on what they've been asking this website to do, both in quantity and also the services that it was going to provide. You worry about, were there changes made by HHS and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid in making changes to what they were asking this website and what the contractors were providing. But then you also worry about technical bugs. I mean, are there problems with the software that's been created and how the site is working? And so we just don't have the answers. Unfortunately, the administration and HHS haven't come forward with answers to some of these questions. And the contractors, I think, are at a point where they're just trying to fix the bugs in the system and get it operating effectively. And so they're not really answering a lot of questions either.
Well, apparently they're going to have to answer some questions before the Congress on Thursday. Three of the main contractors responsible for the healthcare.gov website, CGI, Serco, and Equifax, will be testifying on Thursday.
That's correct. And there's some, you know, basic, you know, questions that should probably be asked. And that is, you know, questions about what was originally asked, what the original budget was for, and then, you know, why all the escalations. Just in taking a look at CGI's contract, you know, even in their own press release, they expected that the total value of the contract would be $93.7 million, and they've already received $196 million, and that contract has a ceiling price of nearly $300 million. So at that point, I think some people need to answer some questions about, you know, why the dramatic increase in spending on this website. And you know, at that point, I would even maybe be asking some of the officials over at Health and Human Services on whether they're going to, once they get the website corrected and it working properly, are they going to be seeking any recruitment of money on this contract? Because it seems as if the federal government
is bringing in some experts to try to fix the technology glitches.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Amey, who is the General Counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, where he directs contract oversight investigations and testifies before Congress and federal agency panels on issues of federal spending on goods and services, the responsibility of top federal contractors, and conflicts of interest and ethics concerns that have led to questionable contract awards. Now, in terms of CGI getting this contract, and you pointed out they've already tripled the amount of money from the $91 million original bid that they put in. They're already tripling it, and they have an even higher ceiling. They are a Canadian company, and I understand that there were problems in Canada with some of their work. So how does the government, or who chooses these people, and do they do their due diligence in looking at their past records?
Well, you raise a great point, and that is the government does, by law, is only supposed to award contracts to responsible contractors, and they're supposed to go through a vetting process. Sometimes at POGO we question the amount of vetting that takes place and whether these contractors, especially ones with patterns of misconduct, are truly responsible and should receive federal taxpayer dollars. But CGI is probably one that didn't pop up on the radar. And in a lot of these instances, the contracting officers that award these contracts get to look at previous problems with maybe federal contracts or contracts that they have had terminated or that where they have been held accountable via a suspension or debarment process. But for the most part, they don't get to see activities at the local or state level or certainly the international level. So I would imagine in taking a look at the basic information that's publicly available that CGI probably came through the vetting process with a clean record. And they also had to bid against other contractors. So at that point, someone inside the government thought that they were, one, responsible, and two, technically capable of performing on this contract. And that's why they were selected. It's only now, hindsight's 20/20. It's easy to sit back and play Monday morning quarterback. But for the most part, I didn't really see anything that would raise a red flag about CGI, other than truly the dramatic cost increase that we're seeing and the fact that we still have a product that's not working.
Well, it seems, though, that there's a history and a pattern here in terms of contractors for government services that were previously done by government employees. And in particularly, we became aware of this with the military, with Halliburton's contracts, particularly given if the former CEO was the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. And they got enormous contracts in Iraq and Afghanistan to this day. And at times, the Army or the military auditors basically gave up. I mean, why is it that you start out with a low bid and end up tripling it in the case of CGI for this botched work on healthcare.gov? Is this just an accepted pattern? You just come in, and then once you're in the door, it's the old nose of the camel deal, right?
Well, you raise very good points. And I mean, we've seen it in the past with especially complex weapon systems that, they're always over budget and behind schedule. Now we're starting to see it in certain examples with IT projects. Not all, but, it does raise red flags on, does a contractor come in? We used the term a few years ago called the politics of contracting, that, do you hire a lobbying team and do you have, different people and campaign contributions that are going that, help, you receive a federal government contract? Are you connected, different things? You hope that at the end of the day that the government is making decisions that are in the best interest of taxpayers and not for the best interest of maybe a former government employee that went through the revolving door or someone that's thinking about going through the revolving door or for the company itself. And, but there are always questions raised. Even in this instance, there's been some issues raised with campaign contributions, with lobbying, the amount of access that they had to the White House in and about the time that this award was made. And so, and also that they've hired some or had consultants on the payroll that were former senior government officials. And so it's instances like that that really cause, I think, the public to think that there's not integrity in the system and that the system is based on, backroom deals or cozy relationships. And that's unfortunately, because I think that really degrades, our feelings about democracy and about how our government works.
Well, subsequent to the revelations about military contractors like Halliburton just writing blank checks and doing stuff that the military used to do. Now, more recently, we've discovered that something like 70 to 80% of all of the money that goes into our vast intelligence budget goes to private entities. And, of course, Booz Allen Hamilton came to light because of Edward Snowden, who was working for this contractor. And it turns out that they get 98% of their money from the federal government. Also, in this mania of privatization, you have the same thing in the education department with these for-profit colleges. And they're able to advertise with our tax dollars on television to encourage kids and vets to join up and get these worthless diplomas and get deeply into debt by these companies basically taking federal dollars and then charging them back at high interest rates. So it's right across the board. And what I find extraordinary is that how does the government get away, or how do we allow, as taxpayers, allow this abuse of the Treasury from companies that have no history of providing any services whatsoever, but just simply pop up out of nowhere and are sole source contracts for the government? They have no other businesses. In other words, if you would have gone to Silicon Valley with some real high-tech talent, I bet you this healthcare.gov thing wouldn't have half the problems it has, because these companies are involved in working on other contracts and they're really truly competitive. But when you have these sole source contractors who came out of nowhere, just hung up a shingle and suddenly have got a government contract and they've never done any business for anybody else, doesn't that raise a flag?
Well, your question had many questions inside of it, but I'll try to handle them as
quickly. Yeah, do, because I'm just on a bit of a rant here, because I find, I find this whole thing so disgusting.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in the United States are, and there's a few different issues. And one is responsibility. Part of the responsibility determination that the government makes includes past performance, includes their ability to be able to, you know, to work on these projects, to get bonded, to be able to do the work, have the technical capabilities or access to take technical capabilities to do the work. And unfortunately, I don't think we're seeing some of that work done. And that's mainly because we're handing money over hand over fist to contractors. And there's an over-reliance on contractors that I think the people inside of the federal government need to get their hands around and start to ask the question, is should this be performed by someone in the military? Should this be performed by a civilian public servant? Or should this be performed by contractors? Unfortunately, we've operated under the opinion that contracting out is both cheaper, more brings in more innovation, and also allows the government to do the things it really needs to do, and we can rely on the private sector to do these other things. And unfortunately, that hasn't always been true. You named a few agencies, but the Department of Energy is nearly 100% outsourced to the private sector. I mean, everyone that runs the weapons labs and our DOE facilities around the country mostly are federal government contractors. Then this next issue you raise about sole source contracting, obviously, any time that we do something with sole source, no bid, or that's even limited competition, that's bad for the taxpayer. I mean, any time that you bring more people to the table and have more vendors to choose from, that's going to help drive a healthier competition. And generally, studies have shown it generally drives better performance as well. And so that's an issue. And then cost. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, this project has gone from about $94 million up to $196 million. And at the end of the day, there's real questions about why did cost increase and where's the federal government in holding that contractor accountable? If a roofer walked into my house and said, I'm going to charge you $5,000 to put on a roof, and at the end of the day, he comes back to collect a check for $10,000, and then that night that it rains and my roof is leaking, you sure as heck better bet that, you know, we wouldn't operate in our normal lives the way the federal government is. And that's where we have to get back to a sense of this is taxpayer dollars and it needs to be protected, and that we just can't allow the contractors to kind of get us actually bent over a barrel or to a point of no return, that we need to just continue to throw more money at the problem rather than placing a burden for the contractor to accept responsibility for doing a bad job rather than just asking for more money to fix it. And unfortunately, inside the federal government, we seem to throw money at the problem rather than asking for the accountable fix on the contractor's dime. And that's where we're wasting a lot of money.
Well, already this has had a profound effect on people's perceptions of the Affordable Care Act, or so-called Obamacare. The Washington Post ABC poll released Monday shows that 56% of those questions say the website's failures are a sign of broader problems to come, which doesn't bode well. Now, the president has come up with this tech surge, but that would seem to me that the tech surge, given the surge in Iraq and the surge in Afghanistan, hardly good harbingers. But isn't it, just in the last minute here, isn't it true that the tech surge is going to involve spending more money on outside contractors to look over the work of other outside contractors?
Well, until the federal government decides that they can hire and retain this type of capability in-house, yeah. Unfortunately, you know, it hasn't been a priority for the government. I think there's been efforts to reduce the size of the public workforce inside the federal government, and it has been also a driving force between, well, let's hire more contractors. And at that point, nobody's really questioned the myth on whether contractors are actually performing better and cheaper than if we hired federal government employees. And I, you know, POGO's been, you know, put out a report on this specific issue. You know, it's called Bad Business, Billions Wasted on Hiring Service Contractors. And at that point, you know, we've actually pushed this agenda, and we're actually even seeing it now within the Department of Defense, that a lot of times they're not even running a proper cost methodology and cost analysis to even determine what is the best and most cost-efficient workforce. And that's problematic. I mean, we're spending over $300 billion a year on service contracts, and that's just hiring labor. I mean, that's bringing people into government facilities, using government equipment, government computers, at government desks. And too often we hear of a federal government employee that retires one day and then comes back to work the next week as a contractor. And we need to start asking a question about whether, you know, what is the best and the best workforce to use for these types of cases, and restoring the capabilities for the government to do some things by itself rather than always relying on the public sector for different types of acquisition solutions.
Well, Scott Amey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Amey, who is the general counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, where he directs contract oversight investigations and testifies before Congress and federal agency panels on issues of federal spending on goods and services, the responsibility of top federal contractors, and conflicts of interest and ethics concerns that have led to questionable contract awards. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Benghazi hoax. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ari Raben-Huft, who is a Vice President of Research and Communications at Media Matters for America. He is the co-author with David Brock of The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. And their latest ebook just out is The Benghazi Hoax. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Raben-Huft.
Thank you for having me.
And why is this necessary? I guess it's necessary because this whole storm in a teacup issue has been going on forever. But have they succeeded in doing anything more than muddy the waters? I mean, we've just had the same sort of rabid crew of Republicans shut down the government and threaten to tank the economy. And now, I mean, even one of the architects of it, Ted Cruz, turned around and welcome government workers coming back to work as though he was responsible for them returning to work as opposed to them being sent home on furlough. And then you had both he and Palin were down there at the World War II Memorial grandstanding about not letting vets in to a memorial that they were responsible for shutting down. So I'm just wondering, in this political environment, does reality have any traction?
Well, among a certain set of people, no. The Benghazi scandal has been going on for 13 months now. And it begins with Mitt Romney's campaign believing this was an electorally salient issue, something that could swing the election in their favor. That obviously was not the truth. It ticks up with this concept that it can they can use this to defeat and undermine any attempt Hillary Clinton would like to make in running for president. And why this book was important to write, with which is where you began, is there's been no significant pushback from progressives to explain the truth about this scandal, and that is very disappointing.
So how much then, you mentioned the Hillary Clinton possible presidential campaign, and that this seemed like a fairly obvious and flagrant attempt to head off that possibility. I mean, at times they seem to go almost insane with their speculation, saying that somehow she staged that accident. And my understanding is that when she collapsed and hit her head, that was actually pretty serious. And if anything, that may have an effect on whether or not she'll run for president more than anything else.
I mean, that was a serious medical issue. And it's really shocking that conservatives were so deluded they would make light of it. They would suggest that she was faking a concussion in order to avoid testifying on Benghazi. But that's how insane this scandal became.
So did the Democratic minority chair, do you think he really took them to task sufficiently? Because ICE has been grandstanding on, you know, he did that, went after the ATF, who, of course, are the perennial enemy of the NRA, and got nowhere. Are you confident that the Democratic co-chair was able to at least deal with reality and perhaps put this guy in his place?
Look, I think the most interesting piece of this has been the efforts made by Daryl Issa to keep Democrats out of these investigations. Traditionally, these committees operate where there's a majority-minority report, where the minority is allowed to participate fully in these investigations, and there have been consistent examples all the way through where Daryl Issa has excluded his the ranking member on the committee from these investigations, excluded minority staff. And he does this because they know that under any nonpartisan, any bipartisan scrutiny, their charges won't hold up.
But in terms of using the media, which is what this is all about, it has nothing to do with the truth. I guess my question is, are the Democrats setting the record straight here? Because this guy is so cynical, Issa.
And I mean, they have an extreme uphill battle, primarily because, and one of the reasons we wrote this book, is Democrats and progressives, especially in the media, have been scared about taking this issue head on because it's confusing, it's complicated, it involves tons of minutia on issues, and frankly, they feel like, why should they give Daryl Issa any credence? And the problem is that gives him free rein to go on Fox, on conservative talk radio, in other friendly venues, and sell lies to the American people.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Rabinhaft, who is a Vice President of Research and Communications at Media Matters for America. He's the co-author with David Brock of The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. And their latest e-book just out is The Benghazi Hoax. So in terms of the ambassador going to Benghazi on the September the 11th of 2012, obviously a fairly incendiary day, is there any clarity over, I mean, as far as I know, it was supposedly opening a book fair, which in the middle of a city that's so politically unstable with, you know, essentially warlords running around with pickup trucks with heavy machine guns, etc. Sounds like something out of Mad Max. Is there any clarity on why he went there on that particular day?
Look, Chris Stevens is unique among the American diplomatic corps in terms of his courageousness. And what people have to realize is Benghazi was not an unfamiliar city to him. He had been in Benghazi as the Libyan civil war was taking place. He actually went into Benghazi. He snuck in on a Greek freighter to set up the U.S. diplomatic presence in Benghazi in the midst of the Libyan civil war. He was somebody who knew all the local players. He knew the militia heads locally. So it wasn't that, and he hadn't been back to the city since he had taken over his post as ambassador. to the country. So it wasn't that outrageous that he would want to visit a city that he was both well-connected and, frankly, very well-liked in by the people, the government, and many of even these militias.
So what happened then? The people that attacked the compound that he was staying in, I understand that they weren't really targeting him, that in effect he was collateral damage because they'd set the car on fire and the smoke went out and he was upstairs. Did they even know he was there?
We don't know the answer to those questions, and frankly, nobody does. I mean, these attacks, there are a series of two attacks that took place on two different facilities in Benghazi. First, the diplomatic compound is what you're referring to, where militia and attackers literally stormed the compound and set fire to buildings, and Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, the diplomatic information officer, died from smoke inhalation there. Then there was a second attack several hours later on the CIA annex about a mile away from the diplomatic facility. And that attack on the CIA annex was with mortars, killing two former Navy SEALs one of whom was sent to Benghazi as part of a rescue mission, actually, to get everybody out. So you're talking about two separate attacks, and with very little information out in public, there is there are more classified details than there are public details, but my assumption is more will be coming out about this in the next year.
So in terms of the first attack, wasn't there early reports that it was something of an inside job, that the security people that were supposedly protecting it had either... They certainly capitulated when the assailants showed up.
So there were two sets of guards at the compound. There was a first set of guards who ran and fled, and those guards were the equivalent of, let's say, the guards you see in a parking garage.
Mm-hmm.
They were literally unarmed guards whose job it was to raise and lower the gate. They capitulated instantly, which is what you'd expect for unarmed guards when you have a gun pointed at their head. There was a second set of militia known as the February 17th militia that was contracted to provide armed security, and there are questions both ways where some fled and some joined the fight.
And is there any indication that it was an inside job that they had...
There's no indication it was an inside job among the people who were in those militias who were there that night. There were instances where, for example, a Libyan police car assigned to the front of the embassy pulled away before the attack. There were indications like that yes, but the bigger point there is that Libya, as you said before, Benghazi was a city full of these militias. You couldn't do business in the city without doing business with these militias. When our rescue teams arrived at the Benghazi airport, and this is documented in a book on Benghazi called Under Fire, it took them a few hours to get from the Benghazi airport to the CIA annex because they had to negotiate with a bunch of these militias.
So the Republican criticisms center around the idea that it was possible to send rescue teams in, and for reasons that they never explained, Hillary Clinton and the State Department dropped the ball and they hung this poor guy out to dry.
Except the rescue team was sent in.
Right. Well, so just explode some of that nonsense, if you will, Ari.
Okay, sure. So there's a number of layers to this nonsense. So the first layer is that the president and the secretary of state did nothing. President Obama, when he heard about this, ordered Leon Panetta to deploy all necessary assets to take care of this problem. Leon Panetta said go, and teams started deploying. Now, Robert Gates said a lot of the people who view the military in this way, who think we're everywhere and can respond in 30 seconds at any time, have a cartoonish view of how our military operates and its capabilities. It takes, when you say fuel the jets, you actually have to fuel the jets, get the pilots to fly them, load them up with bombs, get people on them, arm a team, brief a team, get intelligence from on the ground. So it takes some time to do that. A team did leave. So the first thing is when our compound came under attack, the annex, after figuring they needed to respond, the CIA annex sent a rescue team over to the compound. A second rescue team deployed from Tripoli that arrived in Benghazi several hours after, when they had already evacuated the compound and they had retreated to the CIA annex. There was another moment that Republicans have made light of. Supposedly there was a stand-down order given, except Lieutenant Colonel Gibson, who was the person who supposedly was given the stand-down order, has testified under oath that he was never given a stand-down order. So that kind of blows up that rumor.
So what was the reason why the CIA people weren't able to affect the rescue? And at the same time, they were subsequently attacked after the annex was on fire, right?
So the annex was on fire and burned, basically. The CIA, there were five security people in the compound who were American. Now, they were kind of off for the night. They were inside. Sean Smith was actually playing a video game at the time, and he typed into the multiplayer game. He typed in a four-letter word and then said gunfire. And him and the ambassador were being protected by one group in one building on the compound. The other three were outside. They went to another building to grab their weaponry, and that firefight emerged. People from the CIA annex, when they heard about this, went across town to go get them. While they were moving across town, the building that the ambassador was in is burning. So they retreat to kind of a safe area. The ambassador and the security person who was with them tried to lead the ambassador and the communications officer out through a window. As soon as he opened the window, he realized they weren't following him. He went back in several times to try to retrieve them, could not. Ultimately, the team from the CIA annex found the body of Sean Smith, the communications officer, but couldn't find the ambassador before they decided they had to retreat to the CIA compound.
So, Ari Rabinhaft, in terms of the author of the ebook just out, The Benghazi Hoax, in terms of the attack on the CIA annex, the fact that they had mortars meant that they'd already sighted the place, probably, right?
I've asked about this. Mortars are very hard weapons to fire accurately. And the mortars that were fired were pretty professionalized weapons. The people who did that in the mortar, mind you, this was several hours after the initial attack, had to have some level of intelligence to hit. There was a burst of five mortars, three hit the roof, two men were killed. To have that level of accuracy, you would have to have knowledge of topography and other elements. So yes, that the second attack, you might presume some sort of planning for.
And don't they know who did this? I mean,
the theory is it was Ansar al-Sharia.
Right.
Which is an al-Qaeda-linked militia that operates in the Benghazi area.
And it's hardly a coincidence then that they did it on the anniversary of 9/11, isn't that? That's been a source of criticism, has it not? Because the assumption is that this is likely to be an anniversary, because so often terrorists attack on anniversaries of other terrorist attacks. That's a pattern, isn't it?
Right, but what is the answer? To say there's no criticism, this is an issue where the administration is deserving of no criticism on Benghazi. The Accountability Review Board cited 29 different examples of things the administration can do to improve themselves in terms of security at embassies and consulates and diplomatic facilities. 29 different things. Though that's a very important report. Conservatives, though, have dismissed that report because it doesn't say Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are somehow guilty of leaving men to die. That report is a serious and somber assessment of how to improve security in the region. So it's not an issue of no fault. It's an issue of, do you think this is a grand conspiracy by Barack Obama to leave Americans to die so we can win re-election, which is the accusation the right essentially has been making.
Well, other criticism that's not so rabid suggests that there was a sort of, a mindset that wanted to downplay instability in Libya and to portray Libya as a success. And, of course, so much of the criticism you hear about Libya is that it
will... So the question is, what is the result of that mindset? Did President Obama do something that could have saved these lives? Could this attack have been prevented? And so far, none of the legitimate inquiries, legitimate investigations, have been able to ever make that connection, have been ever a look at the record. This is a huge, for an incident of its size, we have to remember U.S. diplomatic facilities since 1998 have been attacked 157 times. Nine of those times, there were U.S. fatalities. So, and of these incidents, the Benghazi attack has been the subject of 18 congressional hearings. It's been the subject of 25,000 pages of documentation being sent from the administration to the congressional investigators. It's been the subject of hundreds of interviews that congressional investigators have conducted. If there was a there that could tie this to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, I think they would have done it.
Well, I'm glad that you've done this book then, Ari Rabinhaft, in order to, you know, I guess alert people to this hoax that's been going on for so long. And we live in an age of propaganda. It's clear that Fox News is the Pravda of the Republican Party, and we can't expect any decency from them. But I take it you've done this as an attempt to wake up progressives to sort of do some pushback here,
and to say we shouldn't be scared of this issue. We should embrace these attacks, and say we as progressives want to do everything we can to make government work. Because as progressives, we're not about government, we're about good government. And the lessons of the Accountability Review Board, it would be completely appropriate for Daryl Issa to hold a hearing to say, has the State Department done everything in this report to make our embassy safer? That's a completely appropriate investigation to undertake. But they've bypassed that to go on a witch hunt, and that is the problem.
Well, Ari Rabinhaft, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ari Rabinhaft, who's the Vice President of Research and Communication at Media Matters of America. He's the co-author with David Brock of The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. And their latest e-book just out is The Benghazi Hoax. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.